Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Dalkey Archive Press's Black on White. This is the last episode of Season 1, and we appreciate you all tuning in. To complete our first season and our series on the Ulipo, I'm joined by Warren Mahdi. Today, we'll be discussing Georges Perec, especially his novel Life, a User's Manual, or in French, La Vie, Mode d'Emploi. Warren?
Yeah, thank you, Ish. Georges Perec was born in Paris on March 7th, 1936, into a family of Polish Jews who had immigrated to France in the 1920s. His father died at the front on the very last day of the Drôle de Guerre. His mother and other members of his family were arrested, deported, and murdered in the camps. Perec himself survived the war in a Catholic boarding school in the south of France. Adopted by an aunt after the war, Perec studied sociology at the Sorbonne and later earned his living as an archivist at the Centre National de la Recherche Scientifique. From 1965 until his death in 1982, Perec produced what many regard as the richest body of work in French literature in the second half of the 20th century. He died of cancer on March the 3rd, 1982. Above all, Perec was an experimentalist, a writer intrigued by the question of literary form. Although he is best known for his novels, he also wrote plays, poetry, essays, film scripts, opera librettos, and many other texts which elude traditional generic categories. In an interview in 1978, Perec spoke of his goals. Quote, "My ambition as a writer would be to traverse all of contemporary literature without ever feeling that I'm retracing my own steps or returning to beaten ground, and to write everything that someone today can possibly write," end quote. Elsewhere, he suggested that four major concerns animated his work. First, an interest in the apparently trivial details of ordinary life. A tendency toward confession and autobiography, an impulse toward formal innovation, and a desire to tell engaging, absorbing stories. Each of those four tendencies are abundantly on display in La Vie, Mode d'Emploi, Life, a User's Manual, which was published in 1978. It was awarded the prestigious Prix Médicis upon its publication, and has in ensuing years acceded to a place of rare privilege in the canon of the European novel. Maximalist in its conception and its execution, this 700-page book is seen by many critics as the worthiest postmodernist successor to the so-called well-made modernist novel, a tradition amplified by such texts as Marcel Proust's Remembrance of Things Past, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Thomas Mann's Magic Mountain. Yet its roots reach even deeper into the soil of tradition. Like Balzac's Comédie Humaine, like Zola's Rougon-Macquart, Perec intended Life, a User's Manual as a panorama of French society, a global, all-embracing vision of contemporary reality. Subtitled romans, or novels in the plural rather than the singular, Life, a User's Manual is composed of a vast plurality of interwoven stories, 107 of them by Perec's own count. In one way or another, all of these stories concern the inhabitants of a large Parisian apartment building situated at 11 rue Simon Crubelier. And among them, one story comes to the fore. It is the tale of Percival Bartlebooth, a quirky, wealthy dilettante who conceives a massive artistic project as a young man, a project intended to afford him some direction in life, and one that would take 50 years to execute. For 10 years, he would take lessons in watercolor painting. Then, for 20 years, he would travel the world, painting a picture of a different port every 2 weeks. He would send every picture back to Paris as soon as it was finished, where an artisan in his employ, Gaspard Winkler, would glue it onto a piece of wood and cut it into a jigsaw puzzle. 500 puzzles would await Bartlebooth upon his return to Paris thus, and he would devote the next 20 years to solving them. As each puzzle was solved, he would send it back to the port city where it had been painted, and it would be dipped in the water until nothing remained but the original blank paper. Clearly, ironic analogies prevail between Bartlebooth's project and Perec's own writerly task. Life a User's Manual questions the artistic gesture closely and casts the work of art as a game in the fullest sense of that word, in which puzzle maker and puzzle solver, reader and writer, engage in a dynamic interplay through which the work itself assumes meaning. In short, much like Perec's other writings, Life a User's Manual is a reflection upon art and its conditions of possibility. And it seems to me, Ish, that we might read the preamble, which talks about the puzzle and about the puzzle as a model of interaction between puzzle maker and puzzle solver, by analogy between writer and reader. Perhaps I could read the French and you could follow up with the English. How does that sound?
That sounds great. That sounds appropriately playful for the spirit of today's episode.
So here is Perec's preamble to his novel in French. Au départ, l'art du puzzle semble un art bref, un art mince, tout entier contenu dans un maigre enseignement de la gestalt théorie. L'objet visé, qu'il s'agisse d'un acte perceptif, d'un apprentissage, d'un système physiologique, ou dans le cas qui nous occupe, d'un puzzle de bois, n'est pas une somme d'éléments qu'il faudrait d'abord isoler et analyser, mais un ensemble, c'est-à-dire une forme, une structure. L'élément ne préexiste pas à l'ensemble, il n'est ni plus immédiat ni plus ancien. Ce ne sont pas les éléments qui déterminent l'ensemble, mais l'ensemble qui détermine les éléments. La connaissance du tout et de ses lois, de l'ensemble et de sa structure, ne saurait être déduite de la connaissance séparée des parties qui le composent. Cela veut dire qu'on peut regarder une pièce d'un puzzle pendant 3 jours et croire tout savoir de sa configuration et de sa couleur sans avoir le moins du monde avancé. Seul compte la possibilité de relier cette pièce à d'autres pièces. Et en ce sens, il y a quelque chose de commun entre l'art du puzzle et l'art du Go. Seules les pièces rassemblées prendront un caractère lisible, prendront un sens. Considérée isolément d'une pièce d'un puzzle ne veut rien dire. Elle est seulement question impossible, défi opaque. Mais à peine a-t-on réussi, au terme de plusieurs minutes d'essais et d'erreurs, ou en une demi-seconde prodigieusement inspirée, à la connecter à l'une de ses voisines, que la pièce disparaît, cesse d'exister en tant que pièce. L'intense difficulté qui a précédé en ce rapprochement et que le mot « puzzle », énigme, désigne si bien en anglais, non seulement n'a pas de raison d'être, mais semble n'en avoir jamais eu, tant qu'elle est devenue évidence. Les deux pièces miraculeusement réunies n'en font plus qu'une. À son tour, source d'erreur, d'hésitation, de désarroi et d'attente. There you go, Ish. Will you read the English translation of that? It's David Bellows' excellent translation.
Who is also Perec's biographer, is that correct?
Yes, indeed. Yes, he wrote a wonderful biography of Perec.
Was it also called Life a User's Manual?
No, I believe it was called Georges Perec.
All right. So here is the preamble to Life a User's Manual in English. The eye follows the path that have been laid down for it in the work. Paul Klee. To begin with, the art of the jigsaw puzzle seems of little substance, easily exhausted, wholly dealt with by a basic introduction to gestalt, the perceived object. We may be dealing with a perpetual act, the acquisition of a skill, a physiological system, or as in the present case, a wooden jigsaw puzzle. Is not a sum of elements to be distinguished from each other and analyzed discreetly, but a pattern, that is to say, a form, a structure. The element's existence does not precede the existence of the whole. It comes neither before or after it, for the parts do not determine the pattern, but the pattern determines the parts. Knowledge of the pattern and of its laws, of the set and its structure, could not possibly be derived from discrete knowledge of the elements that compose it. That means you can look at a piece of a puzzle for 3 whole days. You can believe that you know all there is to know about its coloring, shape, and be no further on than when you started. The only thing that counts is the ability to link this piece to other pieces, and in that sense, the art of the jigsaw puzzle has something in common with the art of Go. The pieces are readable, take on a sense, only when assembled. In isolation, a puzzle piece means nothing. Just an impossible question, an opaque challenge. But as soon as you have succeeded, after minutes of trial and error, or after a prodigious half-second flash of inspiration, in fitting it into one of its neighbors, the piece disappears, ceases to exist as a piece. The intense difficulty preceding this link-up, which the English word puzzle indicates so well, not only loses its raison d'être, it seems never to have had any reason, so obvious does the solution appear. The two pieces, so miraculously conjoined, are henceforth one, which, in its turn, will be a source of error, hesitation, dismay, and expectation.
I think you have chosen one story out of the many, or one novel out of the many novels, as Perec puts it, to focus upon here. Is it in the 13th chapter?
It is. It is in the 13th chapter. When I think of Life of User's Manual, this is the chapter in my head that sticks out to me. But there's so many of these beautiful little stories that take place in this apartment block that are so colorful and vivid that any person who reads Life of User's Manual could easily pick any of these 99 chapters and it will remember, it will stick in their head so beautifully. And I chose this one because of, like all of the good chapters in this novel, in my opinion, this one deals with a certain kind of monomania of a trapeze artist. And we might do well to discuss Perec's own monomania after I read this selection. So this is chapter 13, Rorschach 1. The entrance hall of Rorschach's large duplex. The room is empty. The walls are in white gloss. The floor is laid with gray flagstones. One piece of furniture in the center, a huge empire desk with a set of drawers fitted in the back piece, separated by wooden pillars, making an arc over the middle, in which a clock is set, with a design carved in it representing a naked woman beside a little waterfall. On the desktop, 2 objects are displayed, a bunch of grapes, each fruit being a delicate sphere of blown glass, and a bronze statuette of a painter standing in front of a full-size easel, leaning back from the waist, tipping back his head. He has a long drooping mustache and curly hair down to his shoulders. He wears a full doublet and holds a palette in one hand and a long handle brush in the other. On the wall, at the end, a large pen and ink drawing depicts Rémy Rorschach himself. He's an old man, tall and wizened, with a bird-like profile. Rémy Rorschach's life, as narrated in a volume of memoirs ghosted for him with indulgence by a writer specializing in that kind of service, is a painful combination of courage and error. He began his career at the end of the 1914-18 war in Marseille Music Hall, doing impressions of Max Linder and other American comedians. A tall, thin man with melancholy, heartbroken gestures and expressions which could indeed remind you of Keaton, Lloyd, or Laurel, Rorschach might have made a name for himself if he hadn't been a few years before his time. The fashion was for soldier comedians, and whilst the crowds flocked to Fernandel, Gabin, and Priagin, soon to be made famous by films, Harry Kubins, that was the name he'd taken, moldered in miserable poverty and found it harder and harder to get his act taken on. What with the war just over, the recent national unity government, and the sky blue conservative victory at the elections, he got the idea of founding a group specializing in rousing brass flourishes, military tunes from Tripoli, square dances, and a kit bag of similar Armentières. A photo from that period shows him with his band. Albert Greenfield, and his Jolly Rogers, wearing a cocky look, a fake kepi tilted to one side, a broad frogged combat jacket, and impeccably tight puttees. It was an instant success, but lasted only a few weeks. The invasion of Paso Doble, the foxtrot, the beguine, and other exotic dances from North, South, and Central America and elsewhere closed to him the doors of dance halls and night spots, and his valiant efforts to adapt Barry Jefferson and his Hot Pepper Seven, Paco Domingo and the Three Caballeros, Fedor Kowalski and his Magyar Minstrels, Albert Szvorsi and his Gondoliers, all failed in succession. In fact, he recalls on this point, only names and headgear changed. The act stayed virtually the same, as they were happy enough to make slight change of tempo, to swap a guitar for a balalaika, a banjo, or a mandolin, and to utter the appropriate baby, ole, tovarich, mio amore, or corazon, occasionally with meaning. Shortly after this, dejected, his mind made up to abandon the performing arts, but not wishing to leave the world of show business, Rorschach became the manager of an acrobat, a trapeze artist who rapidly became a celebrity because of two features. The first, that he was very young. Rorschach met him when he was not yet 12, and the second was his talent for his trapeze for hours at a stretch. Crowds flocked to the music halls and circuses where he was on, not only to see him do his act, but to watch him napping, washing, dressing, or drinking a cup of chocolate on the narrow bar of his trapeze, 90 or 100 feet from the ground. At the start, the partnership flourished, and all the major cities of Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East applauded the amazing feats of the young man. But as he grew older, the trapeze artist became more and more demanding. At first, purely out of a desire to improve, but subsequently from the tyranny of habit as well. He so organized his life that, for as long as he was working in one establishment, he spent his whole time, day and night, on his trapeze. His very modest needs were all met by relays of servants who kept watch below and who raised and lowered everything required above in specially constructed containers. His way of life occasioned no particular difficulties as far as those around him were concerned, except that during the other acts on the program, it was slightly disturbing that he stayed aloft. The fact could not be concealed, and that the audience, though it usually remained calm, let its gaze stray in his direction. The management forgave him this, however, because he was an outstanding and irreplaceable artist. Also, of course, they appreciated that he did not live like that out of mischief, and that it was, in fact, the only way he could keep himself in constant form and maintain his act at the level of perfection. The problem was harder to manage when his seasons ended and the trapeze artist had to travel to another town. His manager saw to it that he was spared any unnecessary prolongation of his sufferings. For trips in towns, they used racing cars, dashing, if possible, at night or in the very early morning through the deserted streets at top speed, though, of course, still too slowly for the languishing trapeze artist. In trains, they took a whole compartment where, adopting a pathetic but at least partial substitute for his normal way of life, he spent the journey up in the luggage rack. In the next theater on their tour, the trapeze artist was in place long before the acrobat's arrival, and all the doors between them and the auditorium were wide open and all the corridors clear, so that he could be back up on the high without losing a second. Seeing him set foot on the rope ladder, Rorschach wrote, and climb back up to his eyrie with the speed of lightning were the happiest moments of my life. The day came, alas, when the artist refused to come down from his trapeze. He had just done his last performance at the Grand Theater at Leghorn and was due to leave that evening by car for Tarbes. Despite Rorschach's and the music hall manager's pleadings, increasingly hysterical appeals from other members of the troupe, from the musicians, the entire staff, the technicians, and from the crowds who had begun to leave but had stopped and returned on hearing all this noise, the acrobat, in a fit of pride, cut the rope he could have come down by and began to perform an ever faster pace and interrupted succession of grand circles. This supreme performance lasted 2 hours and caused 53 spectators to pass out. The police had to be brought in. In spite of Rorschach's warnings, the policemen brought a long fire ladder and began to climb up. They didn't even get halfway. The trapeze artist opened his grip and, with a long scream describing a perfect parabola, he crashed to the ground. After paying compensation to the theater owners who had been trying to get the acrobat for months, Rorschach had some capital left and he had decided to invest in an import-export business. He bought a stock of sewing machines and shipped them to Aden in the hope of trading them for perfumes and spices. He was persuaded to adopt a different course by a trader he became acquainted with on crossing, who was lugging various copper instruments and utensils from valve rods to spiral condensing tubes, from pearl sieves to frying pans and fish kettles. The spice market, so this business explained, and more generally everything to do with trade between Europe and the Middle East, was tightly controlled by Anglo-Arabian syndicates, which, in order to keep their monopolies, did not flinch from even physically eliminating their minor rivals. On the other hand, business between Arabia and Black Africa was much less supervised and offered opportunities for profitable deals. In particular, the trade in cowrie shells and, as is well known, these shells are used as currency by many people in Africa and India. But it is not widely known, and that's where there was money to be made, that there are several different kinds of cowries, with different values for different tribes. Thus, Red Sea cowries, Cypria turdus, are very highly valued in the Comoro Islands, where they can easily be exchanged for Indian cowries, Cypria caput serpentis, at a very favorable rate of 15 caput serpentis for one turdus. Now not far away, in Dar es Salaam, the rate of caput serpentis is constantly going up, and deals are often struck there at one caput serpentis for three Cypria moneta. This kind of cowrie is commonly called the coin cowrie. As you would expect from its name, it is negotiable almost everywhere. But in West Africa, in Cameroon, and especially in Gabon, it is so highly valued that some tribes pay for it with its own weight in gold. With all expenses offset, you could aim to multiply your stake tenfold. The operation was entirely safe, but needed time. Rorschach didn't feel he had the makings of a great traveler and was not too keen, but the trader's certainty was sufficiently impressive to make him accept unhesitatingly the offer of partnership that was put to him when they landed in Aden. Now this story goes on to explain Rorschach's exploits, but I think that what drew me towards it was the trapeze artist. And you know, this comes fairly early on in the book, but it has so many of Perec's obsessions with lists, with artists who will go to the brink to attempt to achieve perfection, but never quite reach it, with stories nestled within stories. And I think this chapter really shows Perec as simultaneously a unique writer, a writer forging his own way, but deeply indebted towards his peers like Calvino and also his predecessors. Like Borges.
That artist recalls Kafka's hunger artists as well. And Kafka was a very important writer for Perec, as you know. You know, in a sense, Kafka is both the acrobat and Rorschach, right? He's both the acrobat and the acrobat's impresario. Acrobatics, it's performing on a trapeze, acrobatics and the notion of performance itself is pretty important for Perec. I think sometimes he felt that people insisted on his performance a little bit too much. When La Disparition, translated as A Void, came out in 1969, it was read by a lot of people as kind of literary acrobatics. Let me remind our listeners that La Disparition, or A Void, is an astonishing 312-page novel written without the letter E, the most frequently used letter in French. And it's cast as a detective novel whose central enigma is the disappearance of the E from the alphabet. It also tells a broader and more somber story about absence, loss, and disaster. And it was written with such a degree of mastery that at least one critic writing a book review when it came out failed to mention that there was no E in the 312 pages of La Disparition. But certainly there's a degree of what the French call difficulté vaincue in that text. In other words, a performance of formal constraint negotiated and vanquished, as it were. However, it seems to me that the broader thematic concerns that La Disparition evinces, which are much like those in W or The Memory of Childhood, Perec's autobiographical novel or semi-autobiographical novel because there are other fictional tales told therein, or even La Vie Mode d'Emploi, Life a User's Manual. It seems to me that those thematic concerns are very important indeed too. And I think they come to the fore in the chapter that you read, whose beginning you read. Why did you choose that as being the chapter that struck you the most pungently-ish?
I think it was roughly around this time that I was reading a lot of Rilke. And in his letters to a young poet, Rilke asks the poet, "Would you rather die than give up writing? And if the answer is no, you shouldn't write." That if the choice was between death and your art, you know, and you gave up your art, then you are not what you need to be. And this sounds almost at some level authoritarian, but at the other level, it's if you must believe in your art to this extent to for it to have these what we hope art can do, which is provide something in the absence of other meanings, in the absence of perhaps organized religion or a political project that is working out, we turn to books, we turn to literature or we turn to art in general to give us some transcendence. And the artist, if that transcendence is cut from them, would rather die. And I think that this trapeze artist is illustrative of that fact. And the correspondence between the Rilke and this really stood out to me, and it's stayed in my memory for years and years, even though it's only like 5-6 pages, but it's burned into my memory. So I selected it because I think it's really strong and demonstrative of the wonders of this work and also of what an artist is.
I think you're right about that, and I think that a variety of concerns are on Perec's mind, certainly writing, but also reading, you know? Also reading as an art, and he took reading very seriously. He says this about reading and its pleasure in W or The Memory of Childhood, one of the books that I mentioned in passing. Once again, I'm reading from David Bellow's excellent translation of this book. Perec says this about reading and its pleasure, quote, "This pleasure has never ceased for me. I do not read much, but I have never stopped rereading. Flaubert and Jules Verne, Husserl and Kafka, Léris and Kuno. I reread the books I love, and I love the books I reread. And each time it is the same enjoyment, whether I reread 20 pages, 3 chapters, or the whole book, an enjoyment of complicity, of collusion, or more especially, and in addition, of having in the end found kin again." Now, that latter statement is extremely important, especially, you know, when Perec formulates it thus, because he lost his family early on as a child. And he talks about une parenté enfin retrouvée, a family or a kin found again in reading. It strikes me as very important indeed. The notion of complicity is very important as well. I think that, you know, in subsequent broadcasts, we'll have a chance to talk about reading more closely with John, I hope, and about what reading represents for people who take it very seriously indeed. But clearly, Perec was one of those people. The complicity that he talks about, the collusion, the sort of articulation, the community that one finds in reading, all that's very, very important, it seems to me.
I'm asking this without any notion that there is this connection, but is Perec's love of Kafka tied to the loss of the Holocaust and of the Jewish people?
I don't know, and I can't speak for Georges Perec. I don't know. My sense is that Perec did not read Kafka because Kafka was Jewish. And Kafka, as you're well aware, died before the Holocaust and so forth and so on. My sense is that Perec read Kafka as a very, very fine writer who was dealing with issues that Perec found very compelling indeed, granted his circumstances. Kafka writes about silence and brokenness and absence and loss and so forth, and those issues are things that Perec grappled with very, very closely in his own life and in his own writing.
Yeah, it's either Walter Benjamin or Adorno who, when reading Kafka, thought that he had predicted the final solution, which I find fascinating. But in Perec and in La Vie Mode d'Emploi, we were discussing acrobatics, but it's never simply acrobatics for the sake of acrobatics. There's no point where, in the sense of the American writers writing at the same time, like Thomas Pynchon, you get the sense that they're just trying to abuse you in some capacities with what they know, what you don't know, what they can show you that they know and you don't know. But in Perec, it's never that way. And it has to do with the jigsaw puzzle, I think, that he is making you complicit in his project. And it's fun. It's a game. You don't solve puzzles. The difficulty of a puzzle is its joy.
Well, I've got to confess that I don't feel that way about Pynchon. I don't believe that he's, you know, belaboring us with what he knows and so forth and so on. But it is true, you know, that Perec's writing has a quality of generosity to it that's very, very rare. He welcomes us in and invites us to play with him, as it were, play in the noblest sense, the ludic act as being, you know, abundantly expressive of our humanity and our, mm-hmm. our will to find articulation with other humans in play. And on the condition that one can imagine that play can be a very serious activity, and there are many people who cannot imagine that, as you know, on the condition that you can imagine play as a serious activity, I think Perec is one of the most playful writers that I've ever encountered, and I say that in high praise. Perhaps I could read just a bit from the translation of La Disparition, A Void, which was written, of course, without the E, and thus one might expect it to be very, very arduous, very, very stilted, and difficult to read. However, you know, even granted all those constraints, it seems to me that A Void is a novel where play comes to the fore without belaboring us once again. In other words, in a way that invites us to engage in the kind of playful spirit that Perec puts on offer. This was translated from the French by Gilbert Adair. Once again, bear in mind that there's no E in this. An E in English, as in French, is the most frequently used letter. One might expect the language to be limping at best, but here it is. This is the introduction. Quote, "Today, by radio, and also on giant hoardings, a rabbi, an admiral notorious for his links to masonry, a trio of cardinals, a trio, too, of insignificant politicians, bought and paid for by a rich and corrupt Anglo-Canadian banking corporation, inform all of us how our country now risks dying of starvation. A rumor," that's my initial thought as I switch off my radio, "a rumor or possibly a hoax. Propaganda," I murmur anxiously, as though, just by saying so, I might allay my doubts. Typical politicians' propaganda. But public opinion gradually absorbs it as a fact. Individuals start strutting around with stout clubs. "Food, glorious food," is a common cry, occasionally sung to Bart's music, with ordinary hard-working folk harassing officials, both local and national, and cursing capitalists and captains of industry. Cops shrink from going out on night shift. In Mâcon, a mob storms a municipal building. In Rocamadour, ruffians rob a hangar full of foodstuffs, pillaging tons of tuna fish, milk, and cocoa, and also a vast quantity of corn. All of it, alas, totally unfit for human consumption. Without fuss or ado, and naturally without any sort of trial, an indignant crowd hangs 26 solicitors on a hastily built scaffold in front of Nancy's law courts. This Nancy is a town, not a woman. And ransacks a local journal, a disgusting right-wing rag that is siding up against it. Up and down this land of ours, looting has brought docks, shops, and farms to a virtual standstill. There you have the first paragraph of La Disparition, of A Void.
Wonderful.
And it seems to me that the constraint that subtends the writing of the text, that is to say, writing a novel without the letter E, is not immediately apparent from a first reading, the kind of reading that one might do with one, you know, flat on one's back on one's couch, which is one of the ways of reading that Perec suggested for La Vie Mode d'Emploi, for Life, a User's Manual.
That's an incredible feat of translation as well, because the translation also keeps the constraint.
It is indeed, yes. As you know, there are several different ways to translate, and this one, having decided to respect that formal constraint, Gilbert Adair was obliged to exercise a depth of resourcefulness and agility that was very rare indeed, and he brought it off with a lot of brio, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. We've talked about constraints on a few of the other episodes, but I think the idea of play is kind of a good way to think about a constraint, the way that you play Monopoly. If you're setting different rules, the game becomes different, the way of play is different. Or there are variations of chess where you change how a piece can move, and that changes the whole rules of the game. So the various constraints of writing literature are that you use language on a page, presumably, that you have those constraints, but it seems that they've created further constraints to expand their creativity and the way that they can play. And the preface you read mentions the word go, and you mentioned on an earlier episode that Perec wrote a treatise on the game of go.
He co-wrote that treatise with Jacques Roubaud and and a friend of theirs named Pierre Lusson. Yes, and it was recently translated in a very lovely translation by Peter Constantin. So it is now available in English translation as well.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Bear in mind that constraint can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. Constraint, you know, at the basis, there are a lot of constraints that people deal with that are not playful. The constraint of you know, poverty, for instance, or the constraint of illness, or the constraint of, you know, being a war orphan, are constraints that are very, very serious. Perec was dealing with constraints that are freely accepted, that are imagined by artists and freely accepted as kind of challenges. We talked about the Oulipo on a previous episode, and Perec joined the Oulipo in 1967, and one Oulipian defined Oulipians in general as, and I quote, "rats who must build the labyrinth from which they propose to escape," end quote. And that labyrinth is precisely the constraint. Oulipians set themselves challenges and then rise to those challenges. So yeah, it is playful. It's seriously playful, it seems to me. La disparition, avoid. You know, it's interesting how the constraint structures that novel. Of course, the language, you know, every word bears the stamp of that constraint, because every word must be a word without an E. So, you know, he published A Void in 1969, and 3 years later he wrote a shorter text, about going about 120 pages, something like that, called Les Revenantes, in which E is the only vowel used. So curious formal relations pertain between those two texts, making them, you know, seen as a pair, undoubtedly the only two texts of that kind, granted their compositional constraints, because not one word is common to both. Avoid using only words without the E, and Les Revenantes using only words with the E. Other things are apparent in Avoid. There are six chapters in Avoid. Pardon me, six parts in Avoid, but the second part is missing, right? In other words, that just like the E is missing from the list of vowels and semi-vowels, A, E, I, O, U, and sometimes Y. You know, there are other allusions to the constraint. There, Perec talks about a hospital bed, where a hospital ward wherein all the beds are occupied with the exception of the fifth. He talks about a set, you know, an encyclopedia set wherein all the volumes are on the shelf with the exception of the fifth, and so forth and so on. He talks about, you know, the figure of the E. He talks about Moby Dick, which is, you know, Moby Dick being the white whale, and white in French is blanc, which also means void, you know, or blank. So yeah, he uses that constraint on a variety of different levels in his novel, and it proves to be, rather than limiting, extremely, extremely productive. Perec wrote an article on the history of the lipogram. The lipogram is a form, you know, that he used in A Void, involving the eschewal of a letter of an alphabet. It turns out that form is a venerable one, attested, you know, as far back at least as the 6th century before the Common Era. There were instances of people rewriting the Odyssey without the without the perniciously sibilant sigma and so forth and so on. But he says at the end of that article, he says to think of the lipogram as something like constraint at the 0 degree, after which everything becomes possible. Which is very counterintuitive, but very, very interesting, to me at least. So he thinks of that constraint not as being something that limits his creativity, but as something that opens on to a field of possibility that he finds very broad indeed.
Yeah. It's incredible, because as much as we can talk about Perec from all these different angles of biographically, why does he always attach himself to loss, or we can talk about constraint, or we could talk about all these other things, or his obsession with spaces, that La Vie Mode d'Emploi gets the entire apartment block cross-sectioned at a single moment in time. And I've taken to, in this book has changed the way that I walk through a city. Anytime I walk through an apartment, I look through the windows and try and imagine the lives of the people that are living in them. And friends and I do this together, and we call it perecking.
You know, he was very interested in space-ish. Mm-hmm. He also wrote a book called Species of Space.
Yeah, and where the essay, An Attempt at Exhausting a Place in Paris, appears.
Yeah, it appears in final form elsewhere as well. But yes, absolutely. Yeah, he was very, very interested in space. And he was also very interested, I mean, you touched on it just a bit in your remark. He was very interested in everyday life, in the quotidian, and in how we come to terms with it, and in the ordinary, how we come to terms with the ordinary. He was influenced by a philosopher named Jean Duvigneau, and that undoubtedly by Henri Lefebvre as well, whom you mentioned in conversation with me. Yes, and I think that he felt that the quotidian, you know, is something that we normally dismiss, but that we should not dismiss. And I think he did a lot in his writing to promote the quotidian, to revalorize the ordinary, as it were, and to encourage us to pay attention to the ordinary as a kind of to the poetics of the ordinary, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, absolutely. And that places him among, you know, people like Proust and James Joyce in their love of memory, dailiness, the lives of daily folk, the items. There's huge lists in Life of User's Manual of just the items, the detritus of daily life that are scattered around the apartment, and the absolute beauty of a desk, a painting, a bookshelf. And they're worthy of our veneration.
And as you know, his first novel was called Things.
I did not know this, actually. Choses? Les choses?
Subtitled A History of the of a story of the 1960s. Yeah, he was very interested in things, and he was very interested in cataloging things, in lists, in catalogs, mm-hmm. you know, in aggregations. So yeah, listing all the things. He wrote a lovely essay called Things That Are on My Work Table. He was interested in things and how we come to terms with things and how things serve to structure our experience and so forth and so on, and how we account for things in literature. Yeah. I think probably that we'll have occasion to come back to him when we talk about reading.
Yes.
In a future episode with John, because you know, I can say for my part that, you know, I thought that I was a pretty good reader before I came upon Perec, but I realize now that Perec, in some sense, really taught me to read. You know, he was very, very important to me in understanding what it is to read a literary text.
Well, I look forward to when we will be able to talk about that in a few weeks' time when we start season two.
Me too. Me too, Ish. And I hope that John will join us then, and we'll learn what he thinks about reading. Yep.
I have my own theories. But thank you, Warren, for joining us and discussing Georges Perec and bestowing all your knowledge onto us. And thank you to the listeners of Dalkey Archive Press's Black on White. We've had a great time. We'll see you soon.
Thanks to you, Ish. Bye.
Bye.